J'invite monsieur, maintenant Monsieur Saint-Laurent à présider la prochaine séance.
Bonjour tout le monde. Hello everybody. We are going to continue the discussion now, seeking to explore other views on this question. And I'm very happy to ask. Well, before I do that, I want to tell you a story because it happened to me about an hour and a half ago. As some of you know, j'anime une émission qui s'appelle C'est la vie, a program about life in French-speaking Canada. Et le sujet cette semaine, c'était les mesures que prennent le ministère de l'Éducation en Alberta pour donner un plus grand accès aux personnes qui ont en difficulté d'apprentissage aux cours d'immersion française. Et dans ce contexte-là, j'ai appris, parce que pour moi c'était nouvel, qu'aujourd'hui, au Canada, il y a 352 000 étudiants en classe d'immersion. Et alors, je voulais simplement ajouter ça à la discussion parce que ça peut peut-être apporter une différente perspective sur certains des éléments que vous avez apportés. And I'm only telling you because I was struck by it. I was also struck by the fact that the research showing that children with learning disabilities can learn French another language in an emerging context as well as those who don't have a learning difficulty. And that was research done by Professor Genesee here. And I also think that talking in the context of bilingualism and biculturalism in its future, it's pretty... I thought it was pretty interesting. So I'd like to invite the members of the panel to join us now, please, so that we can continue our discussion. So Warren Allman, I believe, here, Ellen Gabriel, Fabienne Follat, Catherine Leclerc, and Sherry Simon, please. So I'm going to, we are moving forward at a brisk pace, a good cardio exercise. I'm going to interview our speakers as their turn comes. Warren Allman is a lawyer, a human rights consultant, served as a member of parliament for 31 years, de 1965 à 97. From 1972 to 79, he served as Solicitor General, Minister of Indian and Northern Affairs, and Minister of Consumer Affairs in the Trudeau government. Il a été président des droits de droit et démocratie de 1997 à 2002. Entre 2002 et 2005, il a été chargé de cours en droit international en matière de droit de la personne à l'Université McGill. Il a été élu comme conseiller municipal pour la ville de Montréal en 2005, a occupé le poste jusqu'en novembre 2009. He is now president of the World Federalist Movement. Canada is associated with many different human rights and social justice organizations. He was telling me a bit earlier today that his approach to life came early in the 1950s when he was lucky enough to spend 4 months in India examining some of these very issues. Mr. Allman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, there is, of course, a lot that one could say on this subject, that I was tempted to make comments on Mr. Kersey's address, but I'll resist that temptation because we only have 5 minutes. And therefore, I'm going to concentrate on the question that was submitted to us by the by MISC, which is, does bilingualism have a future in Canada? Well, to begin with, we must recognize that the word bilingualism can have several meanings. It can mean the official status of French and English in Canada. It can mean the commitment of the federal government to serve the people of Canada in both official languages, that is, the right to be served, to get information, to work in either French or English. And finally, it can mean the capacity of Canadians to read, speak, and understand the two official languages in a bilingual in other words, a bilingual population. My answer to these questions, based on all of the meanings, the three meanings, would be a resounding yes, 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 that there is a future for bilingualism in Canada. With respect to the official status, this, of course, is entrenched both in our Constitution of 1867 and 1982, and can only be changed by a constitutional amendment, which is very difficult to obtain. In addition, we have the Official Languages Act of 1988. We have the Commissioner of Official Languages serving as an ombudsman with respect to that act. We have the Parliamentary Committee, which oversees the act and has sessions each year. We have the Official Languages Program, and we also have these now roadmaps setting out the strategy for official languages in Canada, and the new one setting out the strategy for 2013 to 2018 is now before us. Furthermore, all the national political parties support these policies, and I don't see any sign of change. But most important, in answering this question, does bilingualism have a future in Canada, is, in my mind, the growing number of Canadians who not only want to be bilingual, but want to be multilingual. More Anglophones than ever are taking immersion and sending their children to French schools. Many look forward to working, traveling, performing, participating, and doing business nationally throughout Canada and internationally. In a globalized world, bilingualism is a great advantage in government, in business, in law, in sports, in arts, in trade unionism, science, health, and agriculture, and a whole lot of other things. We are fortunate in Canada that our two official languages are two of the world's great languages, two of the five official languages at the United Nations, two of the four official languages at the Organization for American States. We are members of the Francophonie and the Commonwealth. And the bilingualism, not only in government and international organizations, but also extremely valuable in the international civil society. I can remember very well attending the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, where knowing French and English was extremely valuable. When I went to the World Congress of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions in Durban, South Africa, again having those two official languages, extremely valuable. So I see more and more Canadians becoming not only bilingual, but multilingual. You may be born in Moose Jaw or Sherbrooke, but your career may take you to Montreal, Vancouver, Val d'Or, or Flin Flon, or to Geneva, Brussels, or London. With a national or multinational corporation, or with a government agency, or with an international institution. When you are 6 years old, you don't know where your ambition will lead you, where you might wind up. And I think our bilingual status, our bilingual programs in Canada open many doors for that young six-year-old person. Now, in conclusion, let me say that fluency in our two languages should be considered a great benefit, a great asset, and not an encumbrance or a burden. A benefit, in my view, which could be used to great personal and community advantage. In Montreal, we are fortunate to have great universities in French and English, libraries in French and English, theater in French and English, radio, TV, and films in French and English. We have the two great legal systems, the civil law system and the common law system. We have hospitals in French and English, newspapers and publishing houses in French and English, plus a strong presence of other languages, Italian, Greek, Arab, and Spanish. Montreal, in my view, should be a natural site for international organizations, for business and government. Montreal can provide services in not only two great world languages, but other languages as well. This advantage should be strongly promoted, in my view. ICAO and IATA are not enough. When the International Criminal Court was set up in 1985, and I was part of the NGO coalition which worked for the International Criminal Court, I thought that it was a natural fit for Montreal and wanted to see that court established in Montreal and believed that Montreal should have applied for it, but they did not. So to sum up, because my time is coming to an end, does bilingualism have a future in Canada? My answer is yes, absolutely yes. This is not to say that from time to time it will be attacked, undermined, or cut short, but the overwhelming movement, in my view, in Canada and in the world, is to favor bilingualism, both institutionally and personally, and the world is going in the right direction, and there is a bright future for bilingualism, I believe, in Canada. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Warren Alden. I came in on time as well. I'd ask the timekeeper to reset the clock, please, to make sure that we continue in that direction. Notre prochaine invitée, Fabienne Collat, est une actrice primée, une réalisatrice, productrice et entrepreneur. Elle est PDG de Zupim.com, leader charismatique, activiste et philanthrope. Sa mission est de continuer à créer des plateformes qui montrent une diversité de choix, de visages, de points de vue. Fabienne is the president and founder of Fabienne Collat Foundation and several successful international festivals, including the Montreal International Black Film Festival, the Toronto Black Film Festival, and Haïti en Folie, as well as many others. She also created Zara Productions, which is dedicated to organizing cultural events and producing independent content. And I know you, so I know you can do it in 5 minutes. Fabienne.
Thank you, Bernard. Well, what I can say is I think Warren really summed up everything really well, and Pierre Cruzy, there's so many things he said I agreed with, but so many other things I don't quite agree with. I would say this. When I grew up in Haiti, I was born and raised in Haiti. And in Haiti, we speak Creole. Creole is the language from the slave. You know, it was our ancestors' language. And the French people that were the people colonizing us, they brought French to us. So so today we have two languages. We have Creole and French. And for the longest time, French language was associated with the language of the high class, high respected people, educated people, and English and Creole was the language for the poor, the uneducated, the miserable people, and everything. And one day, somebody woke up. I think that was President Aristide, and he said, "We should not be having French as the main official language. We're gonna from today. We're gonna have two official languages, and it's gonna be Creole, both Creole and French. And today, there's no shame in speaking Creole anymore. There's no problem. There's no contradiction. You know, everybody can just be as comfortable as speaking Creole and French in anywhere today. And at school, I was taught that you cannot make it in the world if you're just speaking French and Creole. It's not enough. Although French is a really beautiful language, because English is the main language of the world today, especially if you want to be competitive in this economic world. So you need to speak the language of the majority of the world. So that's why at school they were teaching us French, English, and Spanish as well in secondary school in Haiti. And it's mandatory, because if you don't pass English and Spanish, you don't get your diploma. So here I come today here in Montreal. It was 10 years ago, and I discovered this all those kind of problem about bilingualism, about protecting French, about not, putting laws in place not to encourage people to send their kids to those, to English school or not. And I was kind of, wow, really? I'm really amazed. I can't believe that. Although I understand. And I'm going to just give you a little example of myself. You can understand what I feel. When I came here as an actress, because I was I feel bad to say that like this, but I'm a star in my country. I'm a star actress in my country, really. And I came here with the idea of I'm the Julia Roberts of my country, so I'm going to take over Montreal and work and then be all over TV and cinema. And whenever I would go to a director or to a producer or distributor, and you wouldn't hire me, I say, well, your film doesn't have any black person, so you should take me. I'm diversity. And I would feel that the person felt threatened. The person didn't feel attracted to me, even though I had something to offer. And the person didn't even want to keep on giving me a chance or auditioning me or something, because it was not the right approach. And one day I understood that I should not be coming and threat you and say, you should hire me because I have something to offer you, and you don't understand that, and what the hell are you doing? And one day I understood that, and I changed my way of approaching them, and I said something that looked like, you know, there's so much I can bring to your film, to this character. I mean, that would be something if you would give me a chance. You know, maybe we could do something together in that project. And from that point of view, they found me more attractive. They found that this is somebody that has something to her. And they start hiring me. They started hiring me. So I feel I'm a Francophone, okay? So I'm not talking for myself, but if I were an Anglophone or anybody speaking another language, and I would come here and they would give me so many ways to be forced to learn the language, I wouldn't feel comfortable and I wouldn't fall in love with that language. I think French is a beautiful language. It's romantic. It has a snobbish, sympathetic kind of flavor, and there's a better way maybe the government should use to promote it and to make other people just fall in love with French instead of putting laws after laws, loi 14, loi 101, loi so many things. This is my point of view. Now, about bilingualism in the country, I think it's essential that Canada does provide services in both languages all over Canada, because it's important, as Pierre Cusy was saying. I mean, if I don't speak French and I'm sick and I don't know where in Canada, I'd like to be able to be cured, to be, you know, to have the service. So in hospitals, immigrations, and airports, and so many other places, so it's important. I think we should keep that, and here too in Quebec. However, I think it would be an illusion to believe that the whole country should, from as of today or in the future, be completely bilingual. I mean, can you imagine like a small organization to afford translating everything in English and French, especially if you're in Calgary or if you are in Oshawa? Maybe it's not really relevant to have all services translated. If you are like really where there's not a lot of French people to serve. And for an individual standpoint, I would say bilingualism is the stepping stone toward global citizenship. As I said before, speaking a second language or a third language, or English is my 12th language. So it enhances your possibilities in the world work field. You get better chances of having higher salaries. It opens up your mind and your eyes to see the world a different way, from a different perspective. You go to meet other people, other culture. So it's great to learn other languages. I speak 4 languages, and I really encourage everybody to learn as many languages as you can, because it's, comme a dit Monsieur Curzi, c'est une richesse personnelle qu'on peut donner à tout le monde, qu'on peut traduire. Donc, il y a plein de bénéfices à parler plusieurs langues. Maintenant, in my field, I would add this. We do festivals all over the world now. We're in Toronto, Montreal, and Haiti, and so many things. We promote, actually, Quebec culture in Haiti. Actually, we screened a film with Mr. Curzi in Haiti in 2009 to, you know, pour faire connaître la culture québécoise aux Haïtiens là-bas, tout comme on fait connaître la culture haïtienne et black ici, through the Montreal Black Film Festival, for instance. And what I would say is, we have 5 festivals going on. 2 of them are bilingual. The Montreal International Black Film Festival and the Fade to Black Festival that is celebrating Black History Month. Why do I say that? It's because for those festivals, it costs us so much to try to translate everything, to review everything, to make sure everything is well translated, and you know, so it costs a lot. I think the government should put in place some measures as well to encourage more event and cultural organization to be able to afford translations and to promote both languages. And I would finish by saying that the 3 other festivals that we do, Toronto Black Film Festival, Haiti en Folie, those 2, for example, One is in English completely in Toronto, we don't translate it, and one, Haïti en folie, which we do here, is completely in French. We don't translate it, anything either. It's not because we don't want, it's because it costs so much that we had to make choices. So on an individual perspective, I think bilingualism is not even the future. I mean, multilingualism is the future because people are learning more and more languages. And but I would keep it that way because Berna is just looking at me. But I think, yeah, it's multilingualism is the future of in Canada.
So a very clear distinction for you, Fabienne. Thank you very much. Thank you. And our next guest, Ellen Gabriel, is an Indigenous human rights activist and a visual artist. She was well known to the public as a spokesperson during the 1990 OCA crisis. Since 1990, she's advocated for the collective and individual human rights of Indigenous peoples. Elle a été présidente de l'Association des femmes autochtones du Québec. Elle croit fermement que l'éducation doit être dans les mains des Premières Nations et doit se fonder sur leur langue et leur culture. She's an advocate for gender equity, the revitalization of Indigenous languages, culture, traditions, and Indigenous governing structures. And Ellen, we'd like to hear from you.
Thank you. Olen raadus selle kohegu, katsik sa kosne juudjad stanu ogen jahtu, kan joka agane kentu, otetanu kane sada agane kane kare. Thank you very much for thank you very much for the invitation. I feel like the odd person out in this panel, but I'm very thrilled and honored to have been asked to be here, because I think one of the things that's really important for people to remember is that bilingualism in French and English has always been a threat to Indigenous languages. The policy of linguistic duality in Canada has been a threat to Indigenous people, and I'll say Ogwangwa people because I'm more interested in using our terminology of what we call ourselves, and Ogwangwa just means a human being. And when we refer to Ogwangwa, we also refer to other Indigenous nations. And one of the things that I want to share with you and why I spoke in my language is this is the original language of this area, of this island that you call Montreal, that we call Jofjak, where the people split. And we have been resisting. We are not conquered. We are not extinct. We are very much alive. And we are very much in hopes of reconciliation with the rest of Canada. And I think what we really would like to see is Quebec get involved, Quebec and the other provinces and territory get involved in the process of reconciliation. We have wonderful human rights instruments at the international level, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, that in Article 8 actually protects us from assimilation, but colonization is still going on. And when I hear about two solitudes in Canada, two founding nations of Canada, I call that colonial amnesia. Colonial amnesia because you are forgetting about the Indigenous people, the Ogwangwa people of this land. And what has happened is that, yes, there's recognition of our inherent rights in the Canadian Constitution Act of 1982. Yes, we have the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But one of the things that's really important, and yes, in Bill 101 as well, if I might add, that we have a right to practice our languages. But one thing that's really important for people to understand is that English and French must be taught in our schools, and our languages are marginalized. English and French become the language of the majority. And if we want to have real conciliation, people need to understand the impacts of the Indian residential school. That, you know, in 1996, that's the last time an Indian residential school was closed. And in just last week, on Saturday, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission just, you know, had closed its final ceremonies because there's not enough Canadians that understand that when we talk about reconciliation, that means we need to revive, restore, regenerate, revitalize every single institution that was impacted by colonization. And children in residential school, Stories from my community in Gunasadaga had needles put through their tongues when they spoke. And as an erosion, and that keeps getting, there's different ways to punish children from speaking their languages and discouraging them. And as long as Canada consistently implements the kinds of criteria for education within the schools in our communities, then assimilation will continue. We will continue to lose our languages, which are a fundamental part of our identity as self-determining peoples. We are minorities, perhaps, in population, but we are not minorities in the sense of the people who come here as a refuge into Canada, escaping terrible situations in their own countries, or people who just come here want to come to live in freedom in Canada. We are nations. We are self-determining nations. And when the Royal Commission was enacted in the 1960s, we were forgotten. There's always this assumption that English and French Canada are the ones who rule and dominate the lives of everybody. And what we have been doing is resisting. And we're tired of resisting. And we want people and Canadians to educate themselves on the fact that this colonialism is continuing today. And that the preciousness of our languages, when a language goes extinct, not only does their history become no longer told, but the people themselves die. I look at all the efforts that have been done to promote and protect the French language, and people asked me a couple of weeks ago, what do you want to protect your languages? Well, what have you done to protect your French language? What have you done to protect English language? At the cost and expense of Indigenous languages throughout Canada. Charles C. Mann, in his 1493 book, wrote that there were at least 1,200 Indigenous languages spoken, with many, many diverse family groups within it. In Europe, you have 4 language groups. So that talks about the diversity and the richness of a culture, and there's only 3 that are expected. Sorry, I can't see the time. There's only 3 languages that are expected to be spoken at the end of this century: Ojibwe, Inuktitut, and Cree. The ongoing government policies of assimilation are destroying our languages. It has been proven, as in Creole, that children who are immersed in their languages, at least in the first grades 1 to 6, do far much better academically later on than those who are not. Because those who are not are told that their language is gibberish, that their language does not mean anything. Am I done yet? Yeah? Okay. So I'll end that for now, but it's just food for thought. And as Fabienne has said, English and French are great languages. Pasuskanyakahaga, Anishinaabe, Dene, Iyu, Inuktitut. They're beautiful languages. And maybe if Fabienne can learn 12 languages, maybe some of you here can learn 12 languages.
12?
Is it 12?
Okay. But 4 for now.
Thank you very much, Ellen. Catherine Leclerc is our next speaker. Elle est professeure au département de langue et littérature française de l'Université McGill. Ses recherches portent sur le plurilinguisme littéraire dans les littératures anglo-québécoises, acadiennes et franco-ontariennes, de même que sur la traduction de ce plurilinguisme. She's published articles on these topics in various collective books and journals. One of her articles was published in English in the Translation Studies Journal, TTR. Son étude des langues en partage, cohabitation du français et de l'anglais en littérature contemporaine, lui a valu le prix Gabriel Roy en 2010. Pour ce même ouvrage, elle était également finaliste des prix littéraires du gouverneur général du Canada en 2011. Catherine Leclerc, thank you.
J'aimerais revenir, comme beaucoup d'autres personnes ont fait, sur la distinction entre bilinguisme officiel et le bilinguisme comme pratique. D'habitude, c'est le deuxième qui m'intéresse. Cela dit, aujourd'hui, je vais aborder plus l'interaction entre les deux. Et il me semble important qu'on sache duquel de ces bilinguismes-là on parle lorsqu'on s'interroge sur l'avenir du bilinguisme. Et the two are interconnected. They don't mirror each other, and they don't have to, but they have effects on one another. And I'll give a Quebec example. It seems to me, ironically, that in Quebec, the Charter of the French Language, despite its name, did more than official bilingualism for bilingualism as a practice. Law 101 maintains a balance between English and French that would not exist otherwise, and under it, neither French nor English are hegemonic, so other languages can thrive as well. You probably know that, but Montreal has the highest rate of trilingual people in North America. And heritage languages survive longer here than elsewhere in Canada. So weakness can be a plus sometimes. And I think that's the point about Aboriginal languages too. None of these many languages you talked about were colonizing others. Mm-hmm. And that's why there were so many. Ça ne veut pas dire que le bilinguisme officiel canadien a raté ses objectifs. Ça a été abordé aussi, en particulier en ce qui concerne les francophones des autres provinces canadiennes. Et je vais me pencher surtout sur ce qui s'est passé au Nouveau-Brunswick. Il y a un monde de différence entre les propos méprisants du maire Jones à l'hôtel de ville de Moncton qui sont recensés dans le film « L'Acadie, l'Acadie » en 1971 à la suite de la commission, justement. Et ceux enregistrés par Dominique Payette en 2005, où des anglo-montoniens célèbrent la vie culturelle acadienne de leur ville et sont ravis de pouvoir y participer, en fait demandent d'y être invités. Il y a vraiment un changement d'attitude considérable entre ces deux moments-là. And what triggered the change was precisely the commission. What sustained it was official bilingualism. So it has its good sides too. Official bilingualism as a policy remains ambiguous when it comes to the relationship between English and French. On the one hand, it compensates the actual inequality existing between English and French in Canada by giving equal status to French. On the other, it provides a symmetry that negates factual inequality and makes it harder to detect and address it. C'est Edie Blodgett en 1982 qui écrivait « Binarism in Canada masks, in fact, an anglophone hegemony ». Donc, je dirais qu'il est important d'évaluer les politiques officielles sur la base du cadre qu'elles fournissent sur papier, en quelque sorte, mais peut-être aussi et surtout de mesurer les effets concrets qu'elles génèrent et qui ne sont souvent pas directement liés à ce qu'on peut lire sur le papier. Policies are conventions. It's only logical to want to revisit them from time to time, refashion them according to the needs of today. One trend I find worrisome, however, is the discourse that advocates for official bilingualism dismantling because Canadian society is increasingly multilingual. À ce sujet-là, tant mieux si les effets positifs du bilinguisme officiel peuvent être étendus à d'autres langues. Ce n'est pas à moi de juger quelles sont les meilleures stratégies ici, mais je pense à l'officialisation de certaines langues autochtones au Nunavut, qui suit un peu le modèle des langues officielles, si ça peut avoir le même effet qu'on a vu au Nouveau-Brunswick, par exemple pour le français, ça serait une bonne nouvelle. Par contre, la célébration tout azimut du multi comme prétexte à un démantèlement du bilinguisme officiel risque d'être rien d'autre qu'une façon idéologiquement correcte, en quelque sorte, de revenir au modèle d'une seule langue hégémonique. De ce point de vue-là, il faut bien mesurer les effets. On peut avoir une politique très ouverte sur papier qui a des effets contraires lorsqu'on regarde comment elle est appliquée. Et ça, pas le voir, je ne sais pas si c'est naïf ou si c'est fallacieux, mais en tout cas, c'est quelque chose dont je me méfie, certainement. J'aimerais conclure mon intervention par un exemple d'interaction désordonnée qui est tiré de mon champ disciplinaire habituel, la scène littéraire. J'ai travaillé beaucoup sur des œuvres canadiennes qui mêlaient le français et l'anglais à l'intérieur du texte lui-même. Là, je suis perdue dans mes papiers, mais je vais vous le raconter. Un livre en particulier est vraiment exemplaire. C'est un ouvrage du poète franco-ontarien Patrice Desbiens. Il s'appelle L'homme invisible, The Invisible Man. And it mimics official bilingualism. So you have on the left side a French page, on the right side an English page, and the two are supposed to translate each other, but they don't. And as you keep on reading, you realize that you need the two if you are to get anything about this book. And if you don't get it, you're sent a strong message. So there's that aspect. And it's being interpreted as a denunciation of official bilingualism, which in part it is. But at the same time, what I find interesting is that it borrows its inventive form from official bilingualism. And it creates something that barely exists anywhere else, not in literatures in the French language, not in literatures in the English language, something that's truly unique, truly inventive. And so the mockery here is not just a mockery. Something else is happening. And that's the beautiful side of what possible interactions there might be. Thank you.
And we have one final speaker before we take questions. Sherry Simon is a professor in the French Studies Department at Concordia University. She was co-editor of the Quebec Cultural Review Spirale for 10 years and directed the interdisciplinary PhD in Humanities program at Concordia University from 1995 to 2000. Parmi ses publications, on compte Fiction de l'identitaire au Québec, Le trafic des langues et Cities in Translation, apparaît en traduction française aux presses de l'Université de Montréal. She is co-editor of Changing the Terms, Translating in the Post-Colonial Era, New Readings of Yiddish Montreal, and Failures Opposite, Listening to A.M. Klein. Elle est membre de la Société Royale du Canada et membre de l'Académie des Lettres du Québec. Elle a reçu le prix Killam et le prix André Laurando de l'Association francophone pour le savoir. Madame Shirley va nous parler pour 5 minutes.
Merci beaucoup. C'est un grand plaisir de vous écouter, tout le monde qui m'a précédé. Et évidemment, je vais reprendre certaines de vos idées. Je voudrais juste attirer l'attention sur le fait que ma collègue Catherine Leclerc a rédigé son papier anglais sur un côté, français de l'autre, et elle a décidé en cours de route quel côté qu'elle allait lire. Alors c'est un exemple merveilleux de ce qu'elle préconise elle-même. So, official bilingualism is a noble ideal and a point of pride for us Canadians. In relation, for instance, to our southern neighbors, who, though they are as multilingual as we are, see no advantage in giving legal rights to Spanish, for instance. Official bilingualism is hugely advantageous in the fact that, for instance, the Official Languages Act has given birth to a wonderfully run translation machine which allows the government to function bilingually. Translators are not often given the credit they deserve for keeping bilingualism afloat. Bilingualism doesn't just happen, official bilingualism, it's made to happen through translation. Canadian language industries are known worldwide. Training and research in translation studies and in terminology have put Canada on the map internationally. But translation, as Catherine just said, helps to perpetuate a fictional idea of language relations, the fiction of symmetry that we see on cereal boxes, on government brochures, the mirror image paragraphs that show English and French as being absolutely equal. The truth is that 90% of government translation goes from English into French. That's quite a different image of official bilingualism. This is to say that ideas and policies are conceived in English, then brought over into French. This makes for an unevenness that has been part of official bilingualism from the start. And here one can perhaps understand some of the reasons why Anglophones and Francophones don't have the same perception of bilingualism as a cultural phenomenon. In fact, bilingualism is never equal. Even personal bilingualism is always stronger in one area than another. There is no such thing as the perfect bilingual, that wonderful expression, the parfait bilingue, because there is no perfect to be had, in any language, for that matter. All the same, and for the reasons that Catherine has just said, we must defend institutional bilingualism against Harper's gradual wearing away of our programs and institutions, like the Translation Bureau, which continues to shrink. But we also need to be much more open to other languages. For instance, we need our literary translation programs, which are based on the principles of the B&B Commission, and promoted, in fact, by Frank Scott, who Graham Fraser was kind enough to mention, a Montreal hero of a sort, very much an important thinker and actor in the history of bilingualism and of Montreal. So we need our literary translation programs to be open to other languages, and we can't just remain translating each other, which is what we do. We can't let bilingualism comfort us into thinking that we are multilingual and therefore open to the world. In some ways, official bilingualism closes us off from the world. And as Ellen Gabriel said, official bilingualism is a threat to other languages. So we need to think about what official bilingualism allows us to do, but what is it not allowing us to do? We have limited resources. Everyone's for languages, but what can we do with those resources most efficiently? We need to be open to the changing nature of bilingualism in everyday life. Montreal is not a bilingual city. There is no symmetry of exchange across the city. Montreal is a francophone city, where Law 101 is a necessity. It's a francophone city where English and French enter into a conversation whose terms are continually changing. I think that these two languages have entered into a new phase of dialogue, a dialogue which is more relaxed, warmer, including overlapping forms of expression and fluid ways of being that go beyond ideas of formal equality and exchange. So that in many cases, the label of Anglophone and Francophone no longer apply. And haven't we seen it through this whole event? And so when Pierre Courzy says, vous and nous, I'm slightly, I feel ill at ease. I feel at ease. There are so many of us that are somewhere between vous and nous. And this I'd like to quote Julius Gray, who in a recent issue of Le Devoir said, je ne me considère plus comme anglophone. Je suis un Québécois qui parle français et anglais. Je pense qu'il n'y a pas, he's still speaking here, je pense qu'il n'y a pas de communauté anglophone. Il y a beaucoup de gens qui parlent anglais, mais ils sont très différents les uns des autres. And he says, il reste relativement peu de ces anglophones traditionnels que l'on connaît. So I think there are ways in which we have to change our discourse about anglophone et francophone, and in particular about the idea of l'anglais comme menace and of the very well-entrenched and very well-understandable discourse of the danger that English represents to French. Yes, but there are counterbalancing factors. And if we look at song, rap in Montreal, humorists in Montreal, there's so much mixing that's going on. And just one final point, I think we have to recognize that English is not one thing in Montreal. There is one language, which is that of the historic Anglophone community with its acquired rights and responsibilities. And then there's another English, which is the language of an increasingly globalized and diasporic world. I think the first is disappearing, the second is becoming stronger, but so is a generalized attachment to French in this city. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now have about 15 minutes for questions. There are two microphones which are set up. If you could please
If you have a question, make your way to one of those so that it can be recorded. And I see a gentleman going to the microphone on our left.
My name is Sam Tota. I'll give a point of view from the exterior. I came from Turkey, and I was bilingual already. I still don't understand what's happening in Canada, that you have to put up laws in order to speak certain languages. I mean, my question is, do you know what you're doing?
It's funny, Bernie. Yeah.
Is there anyone on the panel who would like to...
If I might, it just so happens that Turkey is a country that had very rigid linguistic laws. Turkey, in the 1920s, underwent the Turkish language underwent a process of purification, and they in fact had a translation bureau, which was run by Ataturk and the new Turkish government, which aimed at translating international literature into Turkish. This was a good thing, and the purification of the Turkish language may have been a good thing too. But it just shows that many, many countries have language laws and types of language planning that they feel obliged to implement at certain times.
I'd like to add something. My sister went to high school in Boston, Massachusetts, and when she was there, I mean, we're all Asian in the family, but she went to high school over there. And when she was there, she had friends coming from Haiti that had the right to go to lycée français aux États-Unis. That means there's no law in the U.S., for example, preventing somebody from going to Spanish school altogether, or an Arabic school, or a French school, or whatever. I don't have a problem of protecting, if we may apply this word, French. But having laws saying to people, you should not be sending your kids to an English school, I can't understand that. And I understand it for immigrants. I mean, you're coming to the country, we would like you to be accustomed to our rules, to our language and everything. I understand that for immigrants, for newcomers coming from outside of the country. Even if you are Quebecois, Francophone, you don't even have the choice to send your kids to an English school if you are a Quebecois. I mean, it's your freedom to choose if you want to adopt this language altogether for your kids. Because even in marriages, you can divorce. I mean, if a Quebecois pure laine wants to divorce from French and adopt another language, I mean, he should be having the right to do so without being punished and without punishing his future generation. This being said, I know Mr. Crozy doesn't agree with me. I can feel him, but... boiling. But I believe if you have to have laws... to force people into learning a language. I mean, you're not heading to the right direction. And the more you force, the more people resist, and the more people move to other cities to make their kids go to that school and then come back later, maybe, or something like this. So.
Yeah. I wanted to say, sir, that it's not only countries that have laws protecting minority languages, but the UN, in 1960, there was a UNESCO treaty to protect minorities in the right to education in their own language. In 1966, of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, in Article 27, that article protects minority language rights. And in 1992, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Minorities also protects minority rights in education, generally in language rights. So it's at an international level that this is considered a serious matter as well, not just at the national level. In many countries, whether it's Belgium or Finland or South Africa or wherever, many countries have laws to protect minority language rights and other minority rights.
Thank you.
Yes. Voici ce que j'aimerais vous dire. J'ai vécu à Bruxelles avec ma famille. Je suis d'origine européenne,
Je suis née en Europe. Je suis venue ici, j'avais 12 ans. Ça fait longtemps. Et lorsque nous sommes partis à Bruxelles, j'ai souhaité, que j'ai plusieurs enfants, que ma fille, une de mes filles qui était en âge d'aller fréquenter l'école secondaire, fréquente l'école européenne. L'école européenne, c'est l'école qui a été... Il y a un réseau d'écoles européennes qui sont créées par l'Union européenne, qui sont destinées prioritairement aux enfants des fonctionnaires de l'Union européenne, de la Commission à Bruxelles. Or, ni moi ni son père ne travaillons comme fonctionnaires européens, mais nous étions là pour un expat et j'ai fait les démarches en me disant que j'ai rien à perdre si j'ai refusé. Il se trouvait que je souhaitais que ma fille, nous sommes francophones à 100% dans la famille, c'est incontestable, qu'elle fréquente une section anglophone pour des raisons que tout le monde peut comprendre. Je me suis présentée, j'ai dit écoutez, j'aimerais qu'elle soit inscrite dans la section Irish-British. On m'a dit, ben, ça tombe bien, on vient de diviser, on a divisé la section, il y avait trop de demandes, parce qu'on a trop d'anglophones, on va l'accepter, mais dit, quelle est sa citoyenneté? Alors j'ai dit, écoutez, je suis vraiment embarrassée parce qu'elle est canadienne, et elle est aussi européenne, elle a un passeport européen. Elle m'a dit, bon d'accord, il n'y a pas de problème, on va la prendre. Et elle m'a dit, écoutez-moi bien, elle m'a dit, c'est dans les fondements même de l'esprit de l'école européenne. Dans aucun cas, nous n'accepterons un enfant ressortissant d'un pays qui parle une langue maternelle dans une autre section. C'est hors de question. Alors, les choses, un jeune grec qui va aller dans la section allemande ou un scandinave qui est dans la section espagnole, c'est niet, non. On ne veut pas du tout que l'école soit un élément d'acculturation. Mais à l'intérieur de l'école européenne, tous les enfants, tous les jeunes doivent apprendre au minimum deux autres langues. C'est-à-dire, vous pourrez prendre n'importe quoi, italien, je vous ai pas mes détails. Ok, donc ma fille a fait en anglais, alors elle a fait français, bon, français avancé et espagnol. Alors je voulais vous dire que, en ce qui concerne la loi 101, je ne vois pas pourquoi on fait toutes sortes d'histoires avec ça. Il y a toujours moyen d'apprendre l'autre langue. Je suis multilingue, je suis anglophone, je parle anglais comme je parle français, j'ai vécu en Ontario un peu. Il faut arrêter de faire des histoires dont il n'y en a pas. L'important, c'est de consolider sa langue maternelle. Et ça aussi, c'est aussi important pour les autochtones, pour les Inuits dont j'ai l'expérience. Okay, ça, c'est fondamental pour l'assise culturelle et linguistique de l'individu. Et ce que je voudrais dire autre chose, c'est que mon autre enfant, on est revenu ici, nous sommes francophones, et elle a obtenu une dérogation de la loi 101 pour aller à l'école anglaise. Et c'est pour vous prouver que la loi 101 n'est pas du tout rigide et rien. On l'aurait jamais dû accepter. Elle a été acceptée dans une école anglaise quand ils se sont rendus compte que mon enfant était profondément francophone, qu'il n'y avait aucun risque d'acculturation ou de défrancisation parce qu'elle avait un problème d'ordre physique. Elle était handicapée. Alors, je voudrais remercier les fonctionnaires de la loi 101 qui ont permis à ma fille d'avoir un bon milieu scolaire, très restreint, une école privée. Et croyez-moi, elle est francophone et elle parle anglais. D'accord. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup, madame.
Oui, bonjour. Ma question s'adresse à M. Fraser, à M. Allemand et à Mme Leclerc. Donc, ici, je voudrais vous poser la question suivante. À mon avis, la politique de bilinguisme du gouvernement fédéral, à mon avis, devrait élargir beaucoup plus son mandat vers un objectif de qualité des deux langues. Parce qu'actuellement, ce qui arrive, le français et l'anglais ont beaucoup de points communs. Premièrement, ce sont deux langues constituées, l'anglais à partir d'autres langues germaniques et le français à partir de la langue latine, le roman, parlé. Il y a eu des interférences. L'anglais a beaucoup enrichi le français a beaucoup enrichi l'anglais avec la conquête normande d'Angleterre, comme on sait, la baronnie anglaise par les français. Donc, il y a eu tout le high English qui est venu du français. Il y a eu une période d'anglomanie en France.
Monsieur, est-ce que je peux vous demander d'arriver un peu plus
tard? Oui, mais c'est pour ça, justement. J'ai besoin de cette introduction pour vous poser la question. Donc, comment est-ce que ces deux langues, au lieu de s'appauvrir mutuellement par uniquement un processus de traduction, comment elles peuvent s'enrichir mutuellement en insistant sur, si vous voulez, la création scientifique littéraire dans les deux langues? pour que les deux langues s'épanouissent. Parce qu'actuellement, comme Madame disait, il y a une langue dominante et une langue dominée, et puis la langue dominante se traduit. Et la langue dominée ne crée rien.
Puis. C'est une excellente question.
La deuxième question,
on va le prendre la fois.
La deuxième
question. Je pense que M. Fraser a très hâte à répondre à la question.
Juste pour vous expliquer un peu pourquoi ça ne fait pas partie de mon mandat et je ne prévois pas que ça va faire partie, c'est que l'éducation est de juridiction provinciale. Et mon mandat, c'est la promotion de l'utilisation des deux langues, mais surtout dans le domaine de juridiction fédérale, et aussi la protection, c'est-à-dire de faire en sorte que les gens puissent recevoir les services du gouvernement fédéral dans la langue officielle de leur choix. Il faut dire que, juste pour répondre un peu à Mme Colla, la politique n'a jamais eu l'objectif de faire en sorte que tous les Canadiens soient bilingues. C'était toujours avec l'idée que tout Canadien puisse avoir des services du gouvernement fédéral dans la langue de leur choix. Et le bilinguisme institutionnel au fédéral veut dire que les institutions puissent servir le citoyen pour que le citoyen ne soit pas obligé d'être bilingue. Donc, c'est comme ça que moi, j'interprète mon mandat.
Et si vous pouvez rapidement la deuxième.
That was clear to me. Yes.
Monsieur, est-ce que... Pardon?
Vous voulez que je pose la
question? Vous êtes capable de la formuler d'une façon...
Alors, à mon avis, monsieur l'Allemand a touché un point très important, c'est que the international status of English and French also. So he enlarged the frame, you know. Donc, il a un peu élargi, si vous voulez, l'envergure, the scope of these two languages. Donc, autrement dit, l'anglais et le français ne sont pas simplement des langues canadiennes, ce sont des langues internationales et ce sont des langues de création scientifique et littéraire. Donc, si on continue à négliger la qualité de l'écriture dans ces deux langues au nom d'un bilinguisme de traduction, 50% de la traduction enrichit les langues, on sait à travers l'histoire. Mais l'autre, c'est de la composition, la réécriture, la création dans ces deux langues. D'accord. C'est ça qu'on doit encourager au Canada si on veut continuer à faire partie des nations du monde.
Thank you very much.
Il faut de la francophonie du Commonwealth.
It applies to both languages, and thank you very much for making that point. Il y a quelqu'un qui veut répondre? Oui.
Un élément à ajouter. En anglais, on dit « beauty is in the eye of the beholder ». Il n'y a pas consensus sur ce qui est un appauvrissement et un enrichissement. Moi, je travaille sur le Shaq, qui est une langue hybride parlée dans le sud-est du Nouveau-Brunswick. Je travaille sur le Shaq littéraire. Je considère que c'est un enrichissement. Il y a beaucoup, beaucoup de gens qui ne sont pas d'accord avec moi.
Merci beaucoup. We have time for... If you can make them really quick.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. Thanks. So earlier today I was reading Wikipedia and I was reading about New Zealand and apparently they have two official languages, Maori and English, as opposed to English and French. And I'm just wondering what you guys, because New Zealand also, I was reading on Wikipedia that the parliamentary proceedings have to be translated into Maori. And there's actually a lot of government support for Maori education. And there's only 10% of, you know, Maori, people that identify as Maori in New Zealand. But in cities like Winnipeg, there's 10% of people that identify as
Ojibwe.
Ojibwe, Cree, and different identify as Indigenous. But yet the city council of Winnipeg isn't translated into any Indigenous language. Do you think that Indigenous languages, all of them, that should be put into, you know, should be called official languages, and that they should have the same kind of support that French does?
Thank you. Helen?
Thank you for your question. I think given the damages that have been inflicted, we need double the support that English and French languages have, because we are losing our speakers. None of it is a good example where there was a language policy and for the Francophones living up there. The Francophones have jurisdiction and authority over the curriculum in their schools, but the Inuit don't. So, you know, colonization, Canadians really need to learn about colonization that's happening right now. Maori is a good example, but even the Maoris who have said that they have revitalized their language find that their languages are in danger, that perhaps in the end of the century there'll be only a few speakers. It is important for people to remember that there are treaties. There is another Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, so there were 440 recommendations, and barely any, maybe one, was implemented. And that was in 1996. Your commission you're talking about is 50 years old. And I think that's old and archaic, just like Canada's parliamentary process is old and archaic. Treaties is about peace, friendship, and respect. And those kinds of things need to be recognized and put into your schools, just as the Indian residential schools will be in your schools once the TRC is finished. But policies within Canada, recognizing our languages is one thing, just like it recognizes and acknowledges our inherent rights. But we have to go to court all the time, and court costs money. Education costs money. How many people think here that education is free? Do you think the teachers that are teaching you in McGill University do this for free? So if we look at what the kind of support that we need to have immersion schools, we need to have, you talk about literacy and literary. Imagine if one day there's no English or French and you lose the great novelists and authors that tell your stories. When our language becomes extinct, we lose the great storytelling abilities that our people have. And so, yes, and I cannot emphasize this enough, the urgency is today for Canadians to, and especially in Quebecois society, to understand the negative impact that has gone on. And for Canadians and Quebecois and everybody else in Canada to understand that what happened with the Indian residential school was genocide. It's not cultural side or whatever you want to call it, but we lived a genocide. And someone said to me, it's more cultural genocide because there are survivors. Well, were there not survivors from the Rwanda genocide? Were there not survivors during World War II from the Jewish population? This is a genocide that happened in Canada, and it continues today in a different form because we have children buried in unmarked graves in Indian residential schools. We have the highest rates of suicide. So yes, maybe we need triple the amount of support that is needed to restore, revitalize, and regenerate our Indigenous languages, which are precious. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've covered a broad range of subjects, and I'm being told that it's time to move on to the next phase of the conference. I'm sorry for those folks who are at the microphone, but thank you very much for having the part.
What is it? I get too passionate.